everyone, and welcome to the second session of the Intel Hub. My name is Nicole Drumhiller, and I will be doing the introductions and serving as MC during this session. This will be our last event in 2017. We will kick off again with sessions beginning in February of next year. We are currently working out our 2018 calendar of events. Once that is ready, it will be posted on our website. I should also mention that this meeting is being recorded. By early next week at the latest, it will be linked on our website for public viewing. Thank you all for taking part in today's event, which is part of our authors series. In this series, the Intel Hub will have speakers come in to discuss their recent publications. Today, we have Dr. Julian Richards with us. Dr. Richards is one of the leading international figures in the field of social science approaches to the study of intelligence and security. He was awarded his PhD from the University of Cambridge in 1993, after which he spent almost 20 years working in intelligence and security for the British government, before returning to academia. In 2008, he co-founded the Center for Security and Intelligence Studies at the University of Buckingham, of which he is co-director, a regular commentator on security and intelligence issues for national and international television and radio, including BBC, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. Dr. Richards is also a former co-chair of the Intelligence Studies section of the ISA and a regional editor of the International Journal of Intelligence, Security, and Public Affairs. He is the author of four books on aspects of intelligence and security, as well as numerous journal articles and book chapters. His first book, The Art and Science of Intelligence Analysis, was published by Oxford University Press in 2010, followed by A Guide to National Security, Threats, Responses, and Strategies, also published by Oxford University Press in 2012. In 2014, Palgrave Macmillan published his next book, Cyber War, The Anatomy of the Global Security Threat, which sets out to demystify the whole subject of cyber war and provides one with the clearest guides available to the complex landscape of cybersecurity. His most recent book and the subject of his talk today is Extremism, Radicalization, and Security, an Identity Theory Approach, published by Palgrave Macmillan earlier this year, in which he uses identity theory as a lens through which we can understand the contemporary security environment. We look forward to hearing about the insights this can offer those working in the fields of intelligence and security. Without much further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Richards. As I had mentioned in the chat, the participants are currently on mute. We will open it up at the end of the discussion. That's just done to help cut back on background noises. However, I will be monitoring the chat in case any questions arise during Dr. Richards' presentation. And with that, I myself will be going on mute. So, Julian, you should be ready to go. Is the sound all right? I can see DC typing, so that's good news. Dr. Richards, are you able to use your microphone?
Yes, yeah. Hopefully everybody can hear me.
Yes, we can.
Unless I hear otherwise, I'll... Great. your voice is a bit sporadic. I don't know if it's a problem at your end or mine. But anyway, I'll press on for now and let me know if I disappear or you can't hear me. So the first thing I wanted to say is thank you to Nicole and Ruben and Mark and everyone involved in the Intel Hub. This was something I came across relatively recently, and I think it's an excellent innovation. as long as the technology works, of course. I'm very pleased and honored to be given the opportunity to talk a little bit about my latest book. I'm going to try and speak for about 30 minutes or so. I've got a few slides that I'll work through. I'll try and leave some time at the end for questions. But if anyone has any burning questions as we go along, then please do type them in, and I'll try and address them as we go along. Nicole has given a fulsome background to myself. So I'm one of those practitioner turned academics, which is relatively rare in the UK. It's more common in the US than elsewhere. And I'm kind of a political geographer by background. So although I've ended up in intelligence studies, a lot of the theme of what I want to say today is about where intelligence studies meets other areas of social science, and particularly political science, as it's called, in North America. We tend to call it politics over here in Britain. And there's a lot of issues here, interesting issues here about intelligence studies as a discipline, as something that you can study. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about that recently. Mark particularly has been involved in talking about this at University of Texas in El Paso earlier this year. And there's a special edition of Intelligence and National Security recently. Talked a lot of papers there about intelligence studies as a discipline and a science, and perhaps that's something we can reflect upon today through the vehicle of this particular book. So let's talk a bit about this extremism, radicalization, and security and identity theory approach. Now, as the name suggests, this is looking at a particularly pressing security issue, probably the most pressing one as far as we're concerned in the Western world at the moment, which is that to do with radical extremism and terrorism. And this book offers a kind of a case study of the United Kingdom in recent years, looks at what are being articulated as extremist threats in the UK, and in neighbouring countries, and thinks about this notion of identity politics. So this is where the sort of social sciences come in very heavily. So it takes a look at identity theory and identity politics and applies that to questions of extremism, radicalisation, and security in the UK. So within that, there are lots of intersections, lots of overlapping Venn diagrams, as Steve Merrin has called them in the past, to do with social science. So we're talking here about domestic security issues primarily, although, as we know, domestic and international security is intertwined these days, but also questions of identity. Nationalism and identity, the intersections between national identities and regional and ethnic identities, and questions of political myth. Now, one of the things this book does is take a critical discourse analysis approach to examine the issues it's looking at. And within the book, there's a case study of looking at certain narratives from different quarters and applying a discourse analysis to them. Separately, as Ruben knows, this is something I've used as a intelligence studies simulation exercise where students can use discourse analysis to sharpen up their critical thinking and analysis skills, and also to think about their own communication and dissemination in terms of having very clear and objective communications. So in this particular book, I take a set of narratives from different parts of the spectrum. So I look at official governmental narratives about these issues of extremism and radicalization, but also narratives from far-right groups and from what we might call Islamist identity groups. and compare and contrast those. There's a few sort of very specific UK policy issues here, as we might expect, and particularly an area of policy, of quite a controversial area of policy called PREVENT, which is the part of the counter-terrorism strategy that deals with questions of community cohesion and development. The idea of PREVENT, which was originally, when it was launched, called Preventing Violent Extremism, came about very much after 9/11, and particularly after the 2005 terrorist attacks in London. And it recognised that there is, as well as trying to put out the fires and stop terrorist attacks, there's a question of the societal conditions from which terrorism emerges, and a sort of longer-term policy question about how do we stop people being drawn into extremist movements and terrorist movements in the first place before they've actually committed any sort of attack. It's very complicated, very controversial area, because it gets into questions of inter-community relations and community identities and so on. So the book looks quite a lot at that. Although PREVENT is the UK's version of this policy, many countries around the world, particularly across the Western world, now have similar sorts of community-based projects and debates. So there's a lot of wider applicability there. So in summary, what we're talking about here, and this book is interesting to intelligence studies scholars, but it's really talking about the intersection between security and intelligence studies. So questions of global security, national security, and policy, counter-terrorism, counter-extremism policy. So it crosses a lot of areas between different areas of social science. So let's talk a little bit about Britain, if we may, and the case study at hand. Now, Britain, as we know, is the classic, in the words of Benedict Anderson, a classic imagined state. And Britain is actually made up of separate identities, national identities, and in the grand scheme of things, was relatively recent. So the Act of Union in 1707 saw Scotland and England and Wales come together as the United Kingdom. And of course, there's a whole separate and complicated history in the island of Ireland, where at the moment Northern Ireland is also part of the United Kingdom. But overlaid on that, in more recent terms, we've got these legacies of colonialism. Britain, as we know, was a very active colonial power for many years, and that's led to a number of very complex identities in Britain, relating to former migrant communities who came to Britain from the various parts of the British Commonwealth. And we sometimes use the words post-colonial identities, or hybrid and hyphenated identities. So these are identity descriptors where people are using two different aspects, so British Muslim or British Pakistani, British Bangladeshi. We see this a lot. And there's a lot of interesting questions about what does that actually mean in identity terms, and how does it affect politics and policy? More recently, we've seen immigration into the UK from other states in Europe, from other states in the EU. And this has become part of, you can't live in Britain these days without eventually having to talk about Brexit, which is the big issue of the day, namely Britain's decision to depart from the European Union. And although that a lot of that was to do with political sovereignty and economic sovereignty, supposedly, it's inevitably become very wrapped up in identity issues and issues to do with migration and immigration. And there are many in the UK who feel that too many people from other parts of the EU have been coming to Britain and capitalizing on economic opportunities through freedom of movement in the UK. So it's quite from a sort of national and regional identity point of view, Britain is a particularly complex and particularly interesting environment at the moment. Now, within that, there are some particularly interesting questions about the Muslim community, and quite a lot of the book talks about Muslim communities or the community in the UK, because there's some important things happening there as well, and a great deal of very interesting research looking at how members of those communities are changing and transforming and adapting to 21st century life in a country such as Britain. And there's generally a sense that, I mean, summarizing a great deal of complicated discussion, that Muslim identities are changing across the generations in a country like Britain and many other Western countries. There seems to be a shift away from regional identities relating to former migrant groups towards more sort of generic pan-Islamic identities. So as Madhud describes it in the British context, moving from thinking of yourself as Pakistani to thinking of yourself as Muslim. And there's some very interesting cultural expressions of such a shift, some of which are sartorial things to do with women's clothing, for example. So a lot of South Asian migrant communities, the women will wear dupattas, which are very, very loose sort of headscarves. But we're starting to see the emergence of the sort of Middle Eastern hijab amongst younger Muslims. So often in defiance and opposition to the thoughts and the recommendations of elders in those communities. So the key thing here is that these identities are never static. They're very dynamic. There are important changes happening across all community groups, across time and space. And we have to really understand these if we're trying to get to the bottom of identity expressions. Now, a lot of the book also looks at what we might call reactive identity politics. And again, this is a very key issue across the whole of the Western world, across Europe. The rise of far-right and populist movements, most of whom are accreting around anti-immigrant politics and expressions. Many, not all, but many are specifically targeting Muslims within their discourse and their narrative. And this is certainly true in the UK. Now, again, this is an extremely complex socio-political process that we really need to understand to a great level of depth if we're to try and work out what's going on and what the ramifications are. And clearly, a lot of this is to do with the forces of globalization, which are transforming economies. In a country such as Britain or many other Western states, we're moving from a post-industrial to an information age type economy. And there are lots of people in the semi-skilled or unskilled ends of the spectrum who are very poorly equipped for these transformations and find themselves very exposed to harsh economic forces. Creasy and Lechat talk about losers in the information economy. There are winners and losers. There are those who can really capitalize on the changes that are happening, but there are quite a lot of people who find themselves kind of left behind by the changes that are happening. And this leads to fertile ground for extremist, populist, radical movements. And certainly in the UK, we've seen a populist othering of migrant communities. So a way in which the problems people are facing, the issues people are facing, are articulated as being down to migrant communities. Not necessarily fairly, and I'll come on to that in a moment. And Britain has the dubious honour of having a very virulent populist press, which the most popular elements of which take a sort of right-wing view on these things. So newspapers such as the Daily Express and the Daily Mail, particularly, extremely popular. Newspapers, very wide readership, really propagate and exacerbate populist right of centre messages to a great degree. And a lot of these are to do with othering migrant communities and othering the Muslim community. And in a British context, this is often articulated as a sort of angst, an expression of a loss of a way of life at the sort of end of Arcadia, that something, this mythical sense of England and Britain as was in the past is somehow disappearing and being diluted and turning into something that many people don't feel comfortable with. And this is extremely interesting when you look at the narratives about these sorts of cultural expressions about what's going on. Now, one of the key things in here, and this is one of the aspects that's particularly interesting from an intelligence analysis point of view, is that there's a great deal of once one probes into these narratives and starts to look at this in more detail, there's a huge amount of myth and misrepresentation going on. Now, a good example of this is a survey that The Economist newspaper carries out every year, where it asks people questions in Europe, in Western Europe, as you can see from the map there, questions about the Muslim community. And one of the questions it asks is, what percentage of the national community people believe the Muslim communities to constitute? And what The Economist has found very consistently across European countries, across time, is that people tend to greatly over-exaggerate the size of the Muslim community, or what they perceive to be the size of the Muslim community in their country. So in Britain, for example, the Muslim community represents about 5% of the population at the moment, but the people polled tend to think it's closer to about 21%. In Belgium, the community is only 6%, but those polls estimate that it's about 30%. Similar figures in France and Germany and so on. So there's something going on here, something that's probably has a lot to do with the way that the media articulates these things, that people's perceptions about certain issues like this are not necessarily at all accurate. And that can lead to mischievous narratives and articulations by extremist groups. Now, in more recent times, and this is actually something that wasn't explicitly covered in the book per se, but is something that we've seen more recently, particularly since the election of Donald Trump in the US, this whole question about fake news and alternative truths, and this is really fascinating. It's not the first time this has happened in history, of course, but we're living in a very, very important era, and there are very important messages here for intelligence analysis and intelligence analysts. We analysts now have more information available to them than they ever had before in history, unprecedented amounts of information. But the difficulties of working out what's good and what's bad information, what's truthful and what isn't truthful, are becoming ever more challenging. So these sort of intensely well-developed skills in critical analysis are becoming ever more important. Very interesting example recently is the one shown here about Russian troll sites. We're probably all familiar with this group called the Internet Research Agency in Russia that appears to be a St. Petersburg-based troll army that churns out fake news and antagonistic messages. This particular case concerning the UK concerned a Twitter account supposedly belonging to somebody called Texas Lone Star, which was spewing out all sorts of mischievous messages about trying to drive a wedge between the Muslim community in the UK and the wider majority community. And one of the many examples was this picture that was picked up after a terrorist attack on Westminster Bridge in London earlier this year, where a Muslim woman appeared to be walking past a stricken citizen in a very unconcerned way, speaking on her phone. And this was articulated as an example of callousness by Muslim people in the UK at the moment. It was picked up by the right-wing press. It spread like wildfire until it was discovered that this Twitter account was completely fake. There's no such person existed, and this was part of this troll army in Russia spreading mischievous and divisive messages. So we really need to understand these sorts of things, and we need to understand the implications they have for community relations and for our understanding of what it means for politics and society. Now, returning to the case of Britain, the big sort of policy question is about multiculturalism and multiculturalist policy. How multicultural are we? How multicultural should we be? What does it mean for policy? And there've been a generally we've UK has been a rather hands-off multiculturalist country, very secular. It likes to interfere as little as possible between cultural expressions. Very different from some other countries in Europe, notably France, which has a much stricter vision of national culture and that a sort of secular laïcité policy towards the national culture in France. So for example, bans on types of religious dress in public spaces, including schools and so on, apply in France and in many other European countries, whereas in the UK we're generally very averse to such things, and we don't like to interfere in such things. Now, there's been various views in the past. Gordon Brown, a former Prime Minister, said that being a very multicultural nation is something that actually makes us stronger. It's a strength. It's a thing that makes us more effective than other countries. Whereas more recently, David Cameron, also a former Prime Minister on the Conservative side, has said that this can actually be a bad thing. That if you have too little intervention by the state in a multicultural state, you get ghettoisation of communities. You get communities hiding away and separating off from the national culture. He coined a phrase called muscular liberalism as being the answer. So, being liberal to a certain extent on paper, but not shirking the difficult questions and wading into some of these very complex and controversial areas of community engagement. And Salman Rushdie, perhaps it's sort of a rather unlikely source of Salman Rushdie, the novelist who had a fatwa applied against him after publication of a book called The Satanic Verses. He's actually rather circumspect about multiculturalism and says that a lot of it has descended into what he calls cultural relativism, which is where we sort of nominally celebrate different cultures, but in practical terms, there isn't a great deal of intersection and cohesion between the different cultures. So we might make out that it's a great thing, but it's not necessarily in practice on the ground. And of course, he's got cause to feel this from his own particular experience. So what does this lead us to? I'm moving on to conclusions, and there are two sets of conclusions really. There are general conclusions about what are presented in the book about the subject in question. Now, I've just noticed that this slide here should have some things on it that seem to have disappeared for some reason, but that's okay. I'll read them out. So the book presents five key conclusions at the end to do with the state and the UK case study. Now, the first is that, again, quoting Salman Rushdie, multiculturalism cannot unhappen. The globalised world that we live in, the nature of the UK, particularly the fact that it's where it is in Europe, where it is in the global economy. we are inevitably a very multicultural state, and we will probably continue to be so. So we have to find ways of dealing with this. We can't row back from this. Very light hands-off way that we've dealt with this in the UK, for all its faults, appears to be better than hardline approaches and more assimilationist national culture approaches. I think we deliver better security for ourselves by being reasonably hands-off and secular. Identity itself is very circumstantialist and malleable. Identity changes all the time. It changes over time. These aren't set things. Sectarianism is the violent expression of very set and unchanging identities. Whereas the reality is that people don't have set and unchanging identities. It's that they are just labels. People can get drawn into extremist movements for various reasons, and then they can come out again. And that has important implications for policy. Extremist ideologies are important, but individuals become violently extreme. And this is the key policy message here, is that the reason individuals get drawn into extremist movements, and there's been lots of very interesting research about this. I particularly flag up some research by Kathleen Blee in the US on far-right extremist movements. People get drawn into these sorts of movements for a variety of different reasons, often very context-specific, sometimes very sort of happenstance, to do with particular situations that people find themselves in at particular times. It seems to be very individual-based. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important in very particular ways. What it means is that when we're trying to work out who gets drawn into these terrorist movements, we have to start at the bottom with the person, in my view, rather than at the top with the grand ideologies. Because although movements like Islamic State or far-right movements will are very important, we have to focus on them, we have to look at how they're recruiting people. The reasons individuals get drawn into this is often to do with individual case stories. And that's why the final conclusion from the book is that, however controversial they may be, these grassroots preventative projects like Prevent in the UK, which are looking at individual case stories, looking at very much at the community level, have to be the right way to go, in my view, and we have to continue to pursue these policies and develop them. Now, the second set of conclusions, which are not sort of explicitly brought out so much in the book, but which are relevant today, where we're talking on Intel Hub, are conclusions for intelligence studies and intelligence studies scholars. And I've just jotted down three thoughts here. So, firstly, we live in an identity politics world at the moment, where a strong analytical capability against fake and suspect narratives will be increasingly critical. Sadly, a lot has happened politically, as we know, in the last 2 years, and a lot of it is about identity politics, about who we are, who should be allowed in to the national community, who should be kept out. This is identity politics writ large, and their identity politics is riven with fake and suspect narratives that, sometimes deliberately mischievous, sometimes just misperceived and misunderstood. And we've got to be better and better analysts at trying to navigate our way through those paths. Second implication for intelligence studies is that intelligence studies really needs to not be too introspective, in my view. I think there has been a risk recently, well, not just recently, but over many years, that intelligence studies can sometimes be a little bit narrow, in my view, can be look too much at itself, at state intelligence agencies and their processes and their trade crafts. But really, we have to think about intelligence and the intelligence function as being part of the state, part of government, part of policy making. It connects with foreign policy, it connects with domestic national security. It doesn't really have any purpose unless we think about that intersection with the real world of policy and politics. So I'm very much of a view that understanding these case studies about threats, about security threats, about politics, about political developments is really one of the most important and fruitful areas for intelligence studies to concentrate on. And then there were also questions about how the sort of final conclusion is about how modern states, Western states, do intelligence and security in the modern era. And this is where we get into these difficult questions about the balance between civil liberties in the information age and delivering sufficient security and intelligence. So questions about surveillance, domestic surveillance. We've had a lot of debate about that in the post-Snowden era. Some very important debates there about how far should the state go in trying to monitor and surveil communities that may be harboring extremists or terrorists. Where are the lines on civil liberties drawn in the internet world? How much data should states be collecting, and what should they be doing with it, with them? These are key questions for intelligence studies in the modern age, and they connect with these questions about modern security threats, terrorist threats, extremist threats, threats of radical movements, and so on. So that's what this book tries to do. It doesn't say a huge amount about intelligence studies per se, but I think it's very relevant to intelligence studies scholars, and I think it throws up some very important case studies and some intersections between intelligence studies and other areas of social and political science. So there we are. That's all I wanted to say today, and I'll throw it back to Nicole and Co for any questions that there may be.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I went ahead and I've added the microphone rights to participants. If it gets a little noisy, I'll go ahead and mute them again. It looks like Dr. Crosston has typed quite a bit in the chat, so let me see if I can surmise. I would like to know if you could comment on an idea that I think touches upon many of the themes that you discussed today with us, how to overcome the issues of non-integration of migrant communities in Western Europe and the United States. The key point being, is there a form of integration in our modern understanding that is not pejoratively assumed as assimilation? How do we overcome the issue of potential recruits for radicalist ideologies being in the West but never moving intellectually towards being of the West?
Really good question, and it's one that's grappled quite extensively in the book. Not necessarily with a particularly successful outcome. Dr. Crosston will have to read it and see if it helps at all. But and there's many different national views on this, and the sort of difference in opinion in Britain as opposed to France, for example, is very interesting here. Now, personally, I think. I tend to be a sort of legal absolutist, I've been described as by some of my colleagues, where I think all of these things are only problems where laws are broken. So you have to have some certain legal red lines. And beyond that, you should be able in your society, in my view, to allow a certain degree of cultural diversity. And non-integration is not, in that sense, non-integration is not necessarily a problem unless it leads to legal and security issues and problems. And it doesn't always do so. So the assimilationist views, I think, although they have a lot of logic to them, the sense that if you live in this country, you've got to be part of this country. I have a fair amount of sympathy with that, but in practical terms, they can lead to other problems of people forcing out certain cultural and ethnic and religious expressions of identity. And you know, whenever you start banning headscarves or whatever it may be, it seems that experience seems to show that you get yourself into a whole load of other problems that you could otherwise have avoided. So, you know, my view is a fairly hands-off multicultural approach that emphasizes basic national values. I mean, we've all talked a lot about values in our societies, you know, tolerance, freedom, respect, those sorts of things. If we can stress those and emphasize those in ways that apply to all different cultures, then in my view, that's probably the best way to go forward. Because it's remember what I said about this. We live in an increasingly multicultural world. The globalizing world is one where communities move around, they intersect, they mix, they don't mix. We can't sort of make this unhappen, really. It's much more difficult to turn back the tide, in my view. So we have to think about this in different ways, and not necessarily as assimilationist ways that we used to think about them in the past. So that's maybe a rather arm wavy response, but that would be my view.
It looks like there's another question. Do you see an intersection between identity politics and the spawning of insurrection, where one is motivated to acts of violence?
Yes, in short, I mean, identity politics are generally a dangerous thing. In my view, wherever we start defining problems in terms of identities, then we start to go down difficult paths. And this can lead to sectarianism, it can lead to insurrection. So we need to think about this the sort of national culture, the national identity. As you know, everyone's in this together. So I think there's some very dangerous things happening across the Western world in particular at the moment, at the highest levels, about expressions of and promotions of identity politics. And I really think we need to row back from a lot of that, because it's going to lead to security problems.
Okay, it looks like there's another question. Law enforcement, legal red lines beyond that allow for a certain degree of non-integration based on cultural practices or expression of identity. Is this a response to non-logical assimilationist agenda against counter-expression of an individual or group identity?
Okay, let me sort of try and get my head around that question. So, beyond that, for a certain degree, is this a response to non-logical assimilation? Yes, I think the answer to that question is quite a complicated question. I think the answer is yes. That I personally think assimilationist agendas are problematic. To a certain degree, and can create as many problems as they try to solve. Now, obviously, there are risks doing the opposite, but I think that we've seen in other parts of Europe recently that there are real problems with assimilation, and these are leading to extremist and terrorist problems in places like France and Belgium and so on. So I would personally support a much looser approach to this, where a degree of non-integration is, you know, we can describe it as non-integration, but a more positive way would be describing it as sort of cultural diversity, I suppose. That would be my view. So Ruben is now asking, who do we identify as the main aggressors on both sides in a polarized world? Goodness me, that's a tricky question. I think my response to that would be something I said earlier about we need to think about national cultures, national communities, not to point fingers. I mean, here in the UK, there's a lot of ugly stuff has been happening as a result of Brexit in terms of our relationship with other communities, with other parts of Europe, and so on. And we need to think about these in a much less identity factored way, and think about global economies, global polities, and so on. So there are big risks, and we're seeing those at the moment. I think we've descended quite rapidly into a very unsavory identity politics across the Western world in particular, and we need to be really careful.
I think that we're going to have some more questions coming in. I believe there's multiple people writing in the chat now. From Mark, if we understand radicalization and threats to security via the lens of identity theory, does this suggest that the Snowden leaks were damaging to security given what they revealed about Western state practices? That's a fantastic question.
The Snowden leaks were damaging to security. In some ways, I mean, there's a sort of strategic level to this and a more operational level. I mean, at the sort of level of detail, sort of operational level, there, you could say that these links did lead to security risks and security problems, and there is, you know, there's a great number of questions to be answered about the way that Western states have behaved in recent years, particularly in the immediate post 9/11 era, and these things can lead to very serious questions when they come out. But in a way, in a more strategic, longer term way, there could be a strange benefit to this in that we have to get these things out on the table. We have to account for them. We have to think about whether and how we're going to change things. So in a bizarre way, I never thought I'd say this, but the Snowden leaks may have actually led to some very positive things. There are still questions here in the UK. There's supposed to be a thing called the detainee inquiry, which is an inquiry into how terrorist detainees were handled and how intelligence was exchanged on them in the post 9/11 period. And we know that there was very serious and bad things happened, and that there was probably complicity in regimes that abused human rights. And I think that we've really got to get these things out. We've got to have the debate. We've got to think about how we move forwards from them. But in the shorter term, yes, there are risks to security, and there are risks to polarization of communities, and we have to handle that very carefully. Right, Ruben, could you tell us more on the relationship between identity and communication? Yes. Again, I think this relates to narratives and discourses, and particularly identity politics narratives and discourses. And what I do in the book is examine some particular case studies here in some detail. So I look at how a particular far right movement here in the UK, which is called the English Defence League, how it narratizes and communicates and talks about society and politics and economic problems, and analyzes that in intense detail in terms of how it articulates the identity factors there, and deconstructs it and looks at how it links identities to problems, to things like criminality and terrorism and so on. And really ask some detailed questions there about how we justify or not some of the things that are being said. And then in turn, the sort of once we understand those things better, once we understand, once we can really apply a very critical discourse analysis to those narratives, we can then think about our own communications and our own expressions and how we communicate the things that we want to say and how we decouple them from nefarious and suspect identity narratives. So there is a link there. Reuben will know that we're working on a book to do with simulations, the second volume of a simulations book that will be coming out next year, I believe. And I've got a chapter in there about a critical discourse analysis, which makes the connection between the analysis and the subsequent communication. So I think there are things to be gained from discourse analysis in terms of our own communications of facts and situations, as well as our analysis of other people's communications. Right, another question from Matthew. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Yes, I mean this was one of the things that the aforementioned David Cameron tried to sort of grapple with, and this sort of muscular liberalism idea was the logical basis of it was that we didn't succumb to political correctness and we didn't avoid certain things because they were too sensitive and that we called a spade and we tackled these things head on. And there is some logic to that, as long as these things are based on fact and good evidence. So those figures, for example, are very important because, you know, if we're going to talk about the particular groups and particular communities and the size of them and the rate of change of them and so on, we have to base these on solid facts and solid research. And that's where, from an academic point of view, that's where research is really important. And there's a lot of very interesting research going on in the social sciences around community perceptions, community articulations of identity. There's a lot of fascinating stuff about cross-generational questions here about how younger generation migrant communities are feeling as opposed to older ones and so on and so forth. And this sort of empirical research is really, really important and helps us to know what's really going on. And one of the Matthew asked about moving extremist groups off their irrational baselines. I mean, often when you actually talk to people and do some empirical research on how young people feel, you see that they're a lot of the extremist narratives are extremely disrespected actually across large parts of the population, and that people feel much more connected to the national community than we sometimes give them credit for. So that sort of research and the publicising of that sort of research is really, really important.
All right, do we have any other questions from our members in the room today? Well, I think that covers it. Dr. Richards, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a wonderful event and very informative. Again, I wanted to reiterate thanks to my collaborators, Ruben and Mark, all in the room, and I look forward to continue doing these sessions as we move into the next year.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to ramble on today. It was very enjoyable, and thanks so much for all the good questions. It was great.